I'm Tom Hornby, and I guess I'd like to start out by saying among the many things that Barry gave me in my life was getting to know through email this young woman who just finished talking, Harriet. And a lot of what Barry represented is carried on in different chords and notes as a consequence. And I should put in a little plug for her incredible book, which is called Too Late to Die Young. You got a little taste of what she's about, and it's pretty neat. Anyway. I met Barry in the spring of 1963. We were members of the first American Mount Everest expedition. And today actually marks the 42nd anniversary of the day when of our ascent of the Everest West Ridge, wow. Adventure to which Barry was totally committed. We're a team of 20 back then. There's now 8 of us remaining. 7 are here today. I guess I'd like to just take a second and ask them all if they still can stand up. These are Norman Dierenfurth, Arbera Saab, Al Otten, who was part of our West Ridge team, Jim Lester, Maynard Miller, Dick Parnell, Jim Whitaker, and Dave Dingman is the one who's missing in action, waiting for the second of 2 kidney stones to pass. Ouch, yes. But I'd like to share with you today are just 2 moments in the times that Barry and I experienced together. One, the beginning, and one, the end. And some of this has been beautifully spoken to already. The first, I dug out, which took some effort, my diary from Everest, and it was even more of an effort to try to read my handwriting. But I'm going to try to read to you, having translated. This is dated March 24th, 1963. Gorik Ship, which is a couple of hours down from where our base camp was on Everest. Almost on arriving here, Barry Corbin and I spied a most delectable-looking rock needle just across the Khumbu Glacier on one of the fantastically contorted ridges of Nupsi. We scanned it with binoculars, picking out what seemed a feasible route. After some deliberation, we sprung our plan on Norman Dierenfurth that the two of us would go over on the next day carrying our own tentage and stuff, so that as to leave all the Sherpas for you to carry the icefall party up to base camp. With an admonition to be careful not to come to grief before getting to the Big E, he agreed to our request. The next morning, with 55-pound loads, we set out across the rubbly, icy Khumbu Glacier. 2.5 hours later, hot, completely out of sorts, with aching backs, we dragged over the opposite lateral moraine to pitch our tent on a patch of slightly less rocky ground. The following morning, we were breakfasted and off by 7:30 and below zero cold. The climbing was attention-getting, and here I've abbreviated what's in the diary a little bit, on good rock and steep snow. At the base of the final needle, our teamwork really hit stride. I took off my crampons. Barry kept his on. We traded leads. I, the rock, Barry, the snow. To the top of our little spire, which we reached shortly after noon. It was a delightful climb, and the weather was perfect. And we sat there, taking in the view and talking. The descent was slow and careful, but we were back to Gorik Ship in time for dinner that evening. After 11 hours of fairly severe climbing, we felt a tired pleasure that we had put ourselves to the test of climbing difficulties as great as anything we would likely encounter on Everest. The next morning, Barry, Dick Emerson, and I climbed the moraine above camp to examine the world around us through binoculars, including the tiny figures of our team moving up into the ice fall. We came down to lunch and a nap, which was interrupted late in the afternoon by a radio call from base camp. Al Otten reported, "We saw an avalanche. No one in that area, but there may have been an accident in the ice fall. Heard some shouts, only four coming down. 45 minutes later, there's been an accident, an ice wall collapse. A Sherpa's hurt, Jake's probably dead. Barry, Jake Breidenbach's closest friend, stood beside me listening. The words sank sickeningly upon his bone. Little more information came from base that evening. The next day, a dull, snowy, chilly, cloud-shrouded day, there was no longer much doubt, just a soul-numbing acceptance of a tragic change in the way things had been. I wrote in my diary about how impressively Barry went through the episode and how we talked late that night in our tent about Jake and their 10 years of parallel yet dissimilar existence together. A couple days later, as we struggled with whether to forget the West Ridge, just climb the damn mountain and go home, it was Barry who said, "It seems to me the decision about the West Ridge is a little premature, for two reasons, actually. We don't know what the hell we're talking about up there, and I think I, at least, am experiencing the return of the desire to climb." That's the same Barry who, a couple of months later, stepped aside from being on the summit team with the comment, "I think Tom and Willie should go. For one thing, you two have been climbing together. You know each other, and you'll make the strongest team. What's more," he hastened to add, "you're both just about over the hump. This is my first expedition. I'll be coming back again someday." 42 years ago yesterday, Barry and Al Auden pioneered the route up the couloir, then dubbed Hornbein's Avalanche Trap, to our last camp at 27,300 feet. These two intense days that Barry and I shared at Gorik Shep, the great high of virgin adventure, followed by the deep low of loss, began a bond that grew even as it changed over the years that followed, from where I entered his life in part one of it and continued to be a piece of it in the second part after the helicopter crash. About a half a dozen years ago, for reasons that I won't dig into deeply now, I started thinking about heroes. One of them was I just discovered they were still a pretty important part of my life. I came up with kind of three categories of heroes. Some of these are pretty obvious, I suppose. The classical hero of the great feat, like Odysseus, or in our world, Shackleton would be a good example, I suppose. The hero as savior, and here I'd cite my friend Pete Schoening, who died 3 months before Barry did, as an example. When his ice axe belay saved the lives of five falling companions on K2 in 1953. And no less heroic there was the decision that that team, with Bob Craig as one of them here, made to try to get Art Gilkey down off the mountain when the odds against it seemed almost insurmountable to everybody but Pete, of course. The third category of is what I call the ordinary hero. Barry, though he'd have none of it, was one of those for me. Not because he was paralyzed, but because of the way he lived his life and touched the lives of others. It was a matter of style. He sent me his hero definition, hoping it might get him off my hero hook. See what you think. To me, a hero is someone who makes the world better or sacrifices his own interests for a greater, nobler cause. By that definition, we're all heroes sometime, but almost none of us consistently. And then he threw in a little extra bit of it. And by that definition, mountaineering, of course, is pretty much nowhere. Yeah. We agreed on everything but the fact that he didn't like being a hero. But my punchline was that heroes are in the eye of the beholder, not the recipient. So you can be the judge. And if Barry wanted to be in denial about this particular problem, was in my eyes, if he had had any defense at all against being one of Hornbein's heroes, he sure blew it with his dying. As you've heard, last fall he was living on the thin edge of having to give up the self-sufficient life he'd pulled off for most of those 36 years since the helicopter crashed. Last August, he was found to have widespread cancer. He opted to forego dubiously helpful treatment. I've often wondered if he saw this cancer as his exit burden. In early December, he decided it was time to begin a final fast, as we've heard. With his family and a few loved ones tied into the metaphorical rope, a climber once more, he started up the final pitch. I found these last days magical and tearful and hard to assimilate. The joyful sound of grandkids playing, watching Corbett films, reading Winnie the Pooh out loud. Just being together were for me a precious gift and a priceless lesson. So much life. On a sunny, mild December afternoon, with loved ones around him, he finished the climb with the same style and dignity with which he confronted. Where's your hanky, Jim? All else in his life. It was the 38th anniversary of the day he, along with his and my friend Pete Schoening, and John Evans and Bill Long, reached for the first time the highest point on the Antarctic continent. But Barry wasn't the only hero in this final statement of a life handsomely lived. His offspring, John's, Jen, Michael, and their partners, and Barry's once wife, well, twice wife, Mom, Huffy, and Harriet, and Link Hibbard, who stayed with and helped care for Barry during those last weeks, and others were all part of these final days, so sweet and sad and so uplifting. Barry, the meticulous mountaineer, left no loose ends, as many of you know, maybe all of you know. A few days after he died, a letter arrived in the mail that began, "Dear friends, as many of you already know, my life is over and ended." And we've had some of the in-between they're given to us already. "Look for the meaning where you can and cherish mystery when you can't. What more is there to say? Just love."